He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
This podcast includes discussion of self-harm, suicide and sexual assault. Please listen with care. If you or someone you know needs support, you can contact the Need to Talk helpline anytime, day or night, by texting or calling 1737. A wider list of mental health support services can be found on our show page, www.rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby.
Last time on Nellie's Baby.
Hello. I wondered if you might be the person to help me, or if you'd be able to put me in contact with a good New Zealand investigative journalist familiar with Porirua Mental Institution.
Trauma, anxiety, depression. We didn't know how to deal with those things very well, so locking people away seemed to be an easy option.
Yeah, I feel it's wrong to perhaps let a murderer go unpunished. Two rapists and a child to not know her true origins or sister.
It felt like no one explained anything. We were basically left to the mercy of the psychiatrists and the nurses and whoever else was there, but Sydney was in a terrible state when we visited.
It's October 2022, 6 weeks since I received that mysterious email from Sarah, a New Zealander living in the UK who's trying to track down the story of her birth mother, Nellie. Now, I'm trawling through the website of the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse in State Care.
The doctors have come around, site doctors and nurses come around, they told me to lay on the bed and they gave me treatment, yeah. Shock treatment, and I was trying to fight it, you know. I did fight it. It was horrible. It was hell, man.
Over the past few years, the Commission has been investigating the abuse of vulnerable men and women at all kinds of institutions, churches, foster homes, and psychiatric facilities.
Mum saw Paul with black eyes and evidence that he was regularly beaten up. He had unrelenting physical injuries. He told her that the staff would round up the patients and hose them down with cold hoses.
I'm watching videos of testimony from witnesses, victims, their families, and former staff.
Hand on heart, I have not seen an individual staff person being cruel, but the systems in which everybody lived and worked were terribly cruel because you had one group of people who had the power of life and death and daily activity and every single piece of power that you could wish to have, completely dominating another group who had absolutely no power at all.
A handful of these videos come from people talking about Porirua Hospital, the place where Sarah's birth mother, Nellie Wilson, spent most of her life, and the place where Sarah was conceived. Listening to these stories is heartbreaking, but I'm hoping they might help me better understand what life was like for Nellie at Porirua Hospital, and to answer some key questions that Sarah and I have, like, why was Nellie sent to Porirua in the first place? I find some potential clues in the testimony.
Paragraph 32, which is the paragraph that begins ECT was administered, because that's where you describe your understanding of what ECT was used for. And your understanding is it wasn't simply treatment, it was also punishment.
Yes, I might get you to read that if you don't mind. Hannah, thank you.
At paragraph...
One woman, Catherine Hickey, says her brother Paul suffered partial paralysis after being hit by a car as a child. Paul was pretty placid, Catherine says, apart from a single incident when he was a teenager. He lashed out at a fellow patient at a rehabilitation centre, which led to the police being called. That led to a clinical psychologist getting involved, and suddenly Paul was in Porirua, totally against the wishes of his family.
That commissal it left my mother brokenhearted. I know that she tried her best to stop that procedure happening and hoping that there could be some alternative. It seemed very drastic. It seemed very extreme to think that, you know, it wasn't like he had a long list of issues like this. So they took extreme action in our view and placed him in the Porirua Psychiatric Hospital.
A similar story to Paul's came from the Nielsen whānau. Sheree Nielsen Hornblow told the commission that her brother Sydney Nielsen became unwell with supposed schizophrenia as a teenager, and he also got in trouble with the police. He was committed at Porirua, and pretty much as soon as he arrived, he was given electric shock treatment, or ECT. His family was horrified. During the hearing, Sheree was asked by the commission chair, Judge Coral Shaw, about the admission process.
You might not know the answer, but I understand from your evidence that your parents signed some committal papers to have Sydney go into the hospital. Do you know if they were ever asked to sign any consents, or if Sydney was ever asked for his consent to the shock treatment?
I doubt very much if my parents knew that he was even getting ECT. And I doubt very much if actually Sydney gave consent for that, because when my mother found out he was getting ECT, she absolutely hit the roof.
Right.
And spoke to the doctors and the nurses there, which of course we got no response.
This testimony is building an increasingly grim picture of what life might have been like for Nellie at Porirua Hospital. But there's a problem. At Porirua, the patients were divided by gender. There were women's wards and men's wards. And so far, all the testimony I've heard comes from the male patients or their families. I know from talking to experts like Hilary Stace that the experience of state care could be very different for men and women. So not everything the male patients describe can necessarily be applied to Nellie. Plus, I'm hoping against hope that trawling through testimony, I might just stumble across someone who was at Porirua at the same time as Nellie. If I can track that person down and interview them, they could fill in a huge blank spot in the story of Sarah's mother. Unfortunately, scrolling through the website, I can't find a single woman who talked to the commission about their experience of Porirua Hospital. But just as I'm about to give up for the day, I stumble across an article on the commission's website which catches my eye. Its title reads, "The Journey for Women and Girls."
The Journey for Women and Girls. The majority of survivors currently registered with us are male, but women and girls have distinct reasons for being placed in care and have suffered distinct types of harm. For example, we've heard from many women who were sent to homes for being unmarried mothers, where they were treated with contempt and subjected to physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, then coerced or deceived into giving their babies up for adoption. One survivor, Mrs. D, said the matron at the home run by the St. Mary's Homes Trust Board, quote, "punched me and slapped me as I was in labour," unquote, then forcibly removed the baby against Mrs. D's will immediately after the birth.
As I read this article, I can't help but think of Sarah. Was she taken from Nellie's arms in the same way that Mrs. D experienced? I lean in towards the screen and keep reading.
Girls seen as difficult to control could also be labelled mentally unwell and sent to psychiatric institutions. One girl, Beverly Wardle Jackson, said that even at her young age she, quote, "could see the injustice of dumping us girls into mental institutions simply because there was nowhere else for us to go. It seemed as though we were some kind of social experiment," unquote. She said she was sent back to Porirua Hospital whenever she was regarded as being difficult.
Jackpot, Beverly Wardle Jackson. She was several years younger than Nellie when she was sent to Porirua, but it seems the two women were there at the same time. I quickly searched the site for more of Beverly's evidence. For some reason, it's among a group of recordings called context hearings, which is why I didn't find it in my initial search.
Ms. Cooper, good morning. The commissioners welcome you and invite you to read the evidence.
The video shows Beverly's evidence was read out at a hearing in November 2019 by her lawyer, Sonia Cooper.
Beverly is actually unwell. That's the reason why I'm reading this in her place, and I feel very privileged to be able to do it for her. She is a published author, and her brief of evidence comes mainly from her book, In the Hands of Strangers. I was born on 26.
Sonia reads how Beverly was born in 1952. Her parents had both been in state care as children because their families were poor.
I would have to go begging the neighbours for milk for the babies. Our house was also very dirty.
When Beverly was 7 years old, history repeated itself.
On 1 June 1960, I'm aware that my whole family was placed under the preventive supervision of child welfare. During that time, I was sent away for the first time.
Beverly was placed in Florence Booth Children's Home with two of her sisters. The other children were sent to either boys' homes or fostered out. It was Beverly's first experience of state care, but far from the last.
I was about seven when I was.
Beverly spent the next 14 years as a ward of the state, meaning the state replaced her parents as her legal guardian. During that time, she lived in multiple children's homes and what we would probably now consider to be youth justice facilities. She was exposed to neglect and sexual abuse, including by the vicar at the church she was forced to attend as a teenager.
The vicar told me it wouldn't be wise to mention what had happened to anyone because it could get us both into a lot of trouble.
When she was 14, quite soon after the incident with the vicar, Beverly was sent to Wellington Hospital's psychiatric ward and from there was transferred to Porirua Hospital.
I remember being taken to Porirua Hospital in an ambulance. When I saw the sign to Porirua Hospital, I was frightened. We had referred to places like Porirua as nut houses, funny farms, or loony bins. I wondered what I'd done to deserve being sent here. I was only 14 years old. I remember the tears flowing again. Nobody cared about me or wanted to help me.
Beverly describes what it was like when she arrived at the hospital. As I listen, I feel a creeping sense of unease.
When I was first admitted, two nurses told me to take off all of my clothes. The only clothing I was wearing was a nightgown and my dressing gown. I refused. Five nurses all descended on me, and I could feel numerous pairs of hands ripping the clothing from my body, leaving me naked. I was told to put on a nightgown. It was not long before a nurse came into the room, telling me she had come to give me an injection. When I told everyone to get away from me, the group of nurses descended on me again. Two of them sat on me, pinning me with their weight. A number of hands held me down, while the one with the huge syringe thrust a needle into the top of my thigh. I remember that within a few minutes, everything went black and I lost consciousness. I spent the first couple of days at Porirua Hospital locked up in my room. Mostly I slept. I was threatened constantly by staff about what would happen if I stepped out of line.
While she was in Porirua Hospital, Beverly noticed that while most of the patients were older and seemed severely unwell, there were quite a few younger people who she calls welfare kids, kids like herself. She said that these young women seemed to end up in Porirua for their wayward behaviour rather than because they had a mental illness. This makes me wonder about Nellie. Was she put in there because of her health or because of prejudice and misunderstanding? Remember, in the notes, she was described as largely placid and gentle, with occasional outbursts that seemed to stem from frustration. She didn't sound extremely ill. Beverly tried to escape Porirua multiple times before she eventually succeeded, getting to Auckland when she was 17 and pregnant. There, she was arrested and eventually placed before a judge who simply couldn't understand why she was in Porirua Hospital in the first place. He let her go free. Even after reading all her evidence, I still also don't really understand how Beverly ended up in Porirua either. So I decide to get in touch with her to find out more. I don't want to jinx it, but I'm hoping that she might have known Nellie. Beverly says she was at Porirua on and off between 1967 and 1973, and given there weren't that many younger women there, seems likely they may have crossed paths.
Hello.
Hi, Beverly. It's Kirsty Johnston here from Radio New Zealand. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
That's good. I made contact with Beverly through her lawyer. Before her interview, she'd asked me to read her book. I picked it up mid-afternoon. It was so compelling that I finished the whole thing before I went to bed that night. What stood out to me is that throughout this entire story, there was never a clear explanation of why Beverly was committed to psychiatric care. Did they give you like a diagnosis, or did they formally commit you under any kind of act or anything like that?
No, they didn't. Nobody ever talked to me really about, you know, why I was there or anything, but then they came up with this story about myself and other girls that we all had epilepsy, which was totally untrue because none of us had epilepsy and none of us ever took epileptic fits or anything like that. And they medicated us with all sorts of medications and, yeah.
So at the time, like that first time you went to Porirua, I don't know what the medical equivalent is, but, you know, they didn't, like, read your rights or explain.
No, they just came into my room. I was locked up in a side room at Wellington Hospital, and they came into my room. They said, you're going to another hospital. And the next thing I knew, I was in Porirua Hospital.
I asked Beverly to describe what Porirua was like then, what it looked like and what it felt like. Most of the buildings have been knocked down now, so we can't really go and see for ourselves.
Where I was taken was a big building, but it was full of, like, cells, small rooms with wooden walls and varnish, and had a little piece of glass in the door where they could look through. But it didn't have a door handle on the inside of the room. So they locked it from the outside, and I couldn't get out, but they could look in at me.
At first, Beverly was taken to Villa 9, which was a female ward.
It was like a prison. It was like a prison. They had all these rooms where they locked people, and then they had a big day room where in the daytime everybody had to sit. And I was only 14, and I never smoked cigarettes or anything. And when the first time I walked into the day room, I remember my eyes just started watering and watering because all the nurses sat around smoking. Everybody smoked. It was probably about 4 months later that I started smoking.
Beverly also spent time in another part of the hospital, a place called F Ward.
I never knew until sort of later in years what F Ward meant.
F stood for forensic.
meaning the people there were deemed criminally insane.
There were all sorts of people in there that had done all sorts of crimes and, you know, mentally ill. I didn't realise at the time. I thought they were just mad, you know. But was locked in there, and that was one of the worst punishments that you could get. It was just so scary and, you know, so frightening.
From what Sarah has said, I'm pretty sure that Nellie was in both Villa 9 and F Ward during her time at Porirua. So, at last, I ask Beverly the thing I've been really wanting to know. So, Beverly, I was wondering if you might know the woman that we are looking into. She would have been in Porirua since she was a teenager too. She'd be a little bit older than you, I think. She was born in 1940, so maybe she would have been about 25 when you were there.
Yeah.
Her name was Nellie.
Nellie. Yeah, I can't say, you know, that I remember her. And it would all depend on what ward she was in too.
I think she was between them, you know, sometimes in F ward, sometimes in Villa 9 or 6 or 5. She was there her whole life, so.
Woman.
I'm disappointed, but then later in our conversation, Beverly says the name Nellie does somehow feel familiar to her. Even after all this time, the memories of the patients she met at Porirua have stayed with her.
I always think about them and, you know, I have horrible nightmares too. Real horrible nightmares, and sometimes the people that were at Porirua are actually in my dreams.
I say I'll send some photos so she can think more about whether she did know Nellie. But even if she didn't, she says she knew many others like her.
Yeah, I didn't know at the time when I was out in Porirua Hospital, but I actually had an auntie. She probably would have been about Nellie's age, I think. Her name was Audrey Young, and they took her out there because her mother was going to have her gallbladder removed, and she was supposed to be out there for 6 weeks, and she spent the rest of her life in there, and she died there, age 48.
What was the justification for putting her in Porirua?
I don't know. I think maybe she was a bit slow, you know.
There's one more thing I want to ask Beverly about that I think will be really important in our search for how Nellie ended up in Porirua. I think towards the end of the book you said you managed to get some of your records. Did those include your hospital records?
Yeah, but they blacked out a lot of it. They blacked it all out with black felt pen so I didn't read it.
And what reason did they give, like what legal reason did they give for doing that?
They didn't give any reason. They just blacked it all out, the things that they didn't want me to read or anyone else to read, and it was just all blacked out. I asked my lawyer why everything was blacked out, and she said that was just what they did. And that just about everybody had things blacked out in their files.
Do you feel like even if you had the notes, they would have been fair to you or accurate?
I don't know. By blacking them out, I always wondered what they were hiding, what they were trying to hide.
I can tell this is a real source of pain for Beverly. She tells me it's one of the reasons why she gave evidence at the commission in the first place. She wants a personal apology for the way she was treated by the state.
to this day, I've never had an explanation ever as to why, when I was 14 years old, they shoved me out there and, you know, were prepared to forget about me. But I had this, bit of spirit, and I was determined I wasn't staying there.
Even though she didn't remember her, after talking to Beverly, I feel somehow closer to Nellie. It's like I can see Nellie there at Porirua, confined in those wood-varnished wards with all the other women, locked up in rooms with no doorknobs on the inside, with nothing to do all day. It's also reminded me that this isn't the distant past that we're looking into. It's within living memory, even though at times it seems like another world. In saying that, Beverly's battle to get her documents sounds foreboding given our own so far fruitless search for more information about Nellie. But just as I'm about to call Sarah to discuss this with her, I open my emails and I get a surprise. Sarah has finally received a response from Oranga Tamariki, the government department responsible for adoption records. It sounds like they're going to release some information about Nellie to her. The next day, the emails with the documents arrives, and I call Sarah just after she gets it, because I'm desperate, and frankly, after talking to Beverly, a little apprehensive to hear what they've given her. The email is from a caseworker at Adoption Services. She's warned Sarah she might want someone with her when she reads the documents.
This is from Hayley Waugh, who's a senior practitioner at the Adoption Care Services. Yeah, so she was really lovely, and she said, oh, your file information is now being prepared. So they obviously look at your file, and then they prepare something and release it to you. They don't release the file, which is what I thought they would do, but they actually type it up, which is interesting because my parents requested this information back when I was about 5 and got that piece of paper that you've seen. So it's mostly that information on that piece of paper with a few differences. So the information, the overview is that the information is 38 years old. Some of the information...
Sarah begins reading the information. Lots of it is simply a repeat of the letter Sarah's parents were sent when she was 4. Basic data on Nellie's age, her height, her temperament.
Described as being gentle, childlike, very loving, loyal, a little anxious. Kind of sounds like me. Her favourite interest was sewing, knitting and animals, especially cats. There's a bit of information about
the document said Nellie had been a patient at Porirua Hospital since 1973, which was interesting because we previously thought she was committed much earlier than that.
She added that Nellie's condition appeared to have stemmed from either birth trauma or a later traumatic experience. There was no indication within Nellie's family that her low mentality stemmed from inherited factors. On a letter written at a later date in 1988...
We've heard this already. This is the information Sarah's adoptive parents got back when Sarah was a baby. But there is something in these documents that Sarah hadn't known before.
Or they hid that from me, I don't know. It was reported that Nellie had in fact been diagnosed with chronic schizophrenia, which is really... that's the first I've heard of that.
Schizophrenia. I'm surprised. I can tell Sarah is too. Schizophrenia is a cognitive disorder where people experience psychosis, like hallucinations. Usually people talk about hearing voices. Often schizophrenics also experience delusions, like maybe they think they're being persecuted or they're really famous or really good at painting or sport. It can be really difficult to live with, and it usually requires lifelong management. Even if the symptoms disappear, they can reappear. Schizophrenia might fit with what we know of Nellie, Some research shows, for example, that it's more common in people with childhood trauma, but it's also really rare and historically kind of misunderstood, especially in women. Both Sarah and I are remembering what Hilary Stace said, that diagnoses like these weren't always accurate.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem that she would have that, but they didn't really understand it at the time, so you were often just lumped in under something. I mean, she certainly, they don't feel that she'd meet that criteria, but anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting what they said about the birth trauma, or do they mean her own birth trauma, or for maybe when she had that earlier baby? I can't work that out.
I don't know, yeah. I don't know.
This is the kind of thing we're hoping will be in Nellie's mental health records. Was this her initial diagnosis, or did it come later? Is it credible? We just can't tell at the moment. There's another mystery towards the end of the letter.
This was the interesting bit that got me. As you are aware, sadly, Nellie passed away on the 28th of September 2008. Her cause of death was acute ventricular failure, secondary to hypertensive heart disease. So that really intrigued me because, as far as I was aware, that's very different to what the autopsy I read said. I remember the autopsy said cause of death was pneumonia, but not acute. Like, that's a heart attack, isn't it? Acute ventricular failure.
I Google, and it turns out acute ventricular failure is different to a heart attack, but we decide to put the autopsy information aside and come back to it later.
It talks about my birth father, because he's not named on my birth certificate. There are notes on your file, however, that document that Nellie was very fond of a friend she referred to as Johnny, who was of Samoan ethnicity, and she hoped he was your birth father.
This is interesting too, because last time we talked about how we thought the boyfriend was Tongan, not Samoan, but it seems that maybe we've just got our wires crossed on that one.
He was a patient at the same hospital. Now, obviously, I'm not Samoan, so it's obviously not him. The hospital staff provided information that your father could have been one of several men, which is interesting. Nellie was aware that she could not parent you, but after hearing about my family, chose them to be my adoptive parents. She had the choice of four families, but she felt my parents would be the best parents for you. And interestingly, my aunt did as well.
So both Nellie and her sister Mavis got to look at prospective families and to help choose a home for Sarah. That's new too.
I didn't know that she was presented with people. Did you know that?
No, and also my mother, I don't think my parents have ever met her. So I think it would have been like, here are some photos, choose from this. It is really interesting to show that there was some form of like acknowledgement of her. It wasn't just, we're taking this baby away. You know, that they did seem to care about her because they also let her keep pictures and they also wrote on her behalf to ask for more pictures.
Sarah gets to the end of the letter and I can tell she's a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, so that's all they've typed up. So there's a couple of new bits in there. But the most of that I already know. I just find it interesting that they don't give you copies of the actual things. They write it up for you.
Sarah wonders if the caseworker at Adoption Services has redacted information in order to protect her in some way.
She obviously really cares as well. So you've got to think, because someone cares, is there things in there that she's left out?
Mm.
You know, like, you know, it could be anything, but like that they're saying, oh, Nellie slept around, or she, you know, that people took advantage of her or something. Does she leave that out because she doesn't want me to be affected by it? Because there's obviously a lot of care in there.
How would you feel if they were doing that to protect you?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because I guess I liken it because I'm a nanny, so I look after children. So the children that I work with at the moment, you know, they've heard about this film called Ghostbusters. Now, they're only seven, and they really want to see Ghostbusters. And they're really excited about it, and they're like, oh, we want to see Ghostbusters, that sounds so cool. And they go around and they sing all the song. But I know it's like a PG-12 or 15 or something. It's actually, you know, because they're killing ghosts and things like that, so I can't show it to them. But, I mean, that's different because I'm not a child, I'm now an adult. So it's sort of, it's slightly different to that. It's like kind of like they've written their narrative, and it's like, okay, well, if they were provided with this information, it's like, was it a letter? Was it like, can I just see? If it's one of several men, do they name others? Do they say it could be this person, or, you know, is there any more information?
Yeah, I agree. I think we should go back and push for that because it's not the same, right? It's not the same. And also, like, now we're relying on that person's interpretation. And so it's like, if we could see the originals, maybe we would form a slightly different opinion. I don't know.
I'm annoyed on Sarah's behalf. And even though I'm encouraging Sarah to push back, I know the likely result. The agency will dig in and it'll take months to resolve. What's interesting about this process, though, Sarah's back and forth with the adoption services, is that it's basically a repeat of what her parents went through in the 80s. They had to fight to get any information at all about their daughter, including her medical history, which just seems really unfair. Fortunately, Sarah has also got some good news to tell me. She's done a DNA test through a genealogy website. She's hoping it might help in the search for her birth father. Even if he's not on there, one of his other relatives might be, and with a bit of detective work, we might be able to find him.
I couldn't decide between Ancestry and 23andMe, but I think Ancestry seems to be quite good. So I paid for an Ancestry DNA test, so that should come back in like 4 weeks or so.
If Sarah's timing is right, the test will be back just before Christmas. If we're lucky enough to get a match, we might even be able to track down her birth father while she's in New Zealand. Next time on Nellie's Baby.
I noticed her profile says private, and so does her father's, and it says living, which could mean that they've seen me and gone, oh, quick, we don't want her to contact us, let's make it that. Or it could mean they just have it's private.
Thanks for listening to Nellie's Baby. If you liked this program, make sure to follow or subscribe using your favourite podcast app or listen ad-free at rnz.co.nz. While you're there, you can browse RNZ's excellent range of podcasts like Dear Wars, Conviction, and The Detail, our daily news podcast. You can also find a whole lot of Nellie's Baby's extras, including feature articles, photographs, and bonus podcasts at our show page, rnz.co.nz/Nellie's Baby, and that's Nellie spelled N-E-L-L-I-E.
Nellie's Baby is written and presented by Kirsty Johnston. The executive producers are John Hartevelt and Tim Watkin. The producers are William Ray and Justin Gregory. The sound engineers are Phil Benge, Mark Chesterman and William Saunders. Our designer is Hing Yi Kong and our videographer is Cole Easton Farrelly. Our audio production team includes Steve Burridge, Jeremy Ansell, Rangi Powick, Corey Fuimaono, Daniel Hurley and Blair Stagpool. Special thanks to all those who helped make this podcast, including Sarah, Hilary Stace and Dr. Olive Webb. Ka kite anō.